You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
I'm happy to welcome Christina Rice back to the show. Christina Rice is the author of the superb biography and Dvorak, Hollywood's Forgotten Rebel, a book that took years to write and that I highly recommend. And she's also the author of several My Little Pony comic books. I haven't read those because they're too scary. And Christina Rice's new book is another great biography of a Hollywood legend, Mean, Moody, Magnificent, Jane Russell and the Marketing of a Hollywood Legend. Christina Rice, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. And I have to say, you really nailed that, the reading of the title of the Jane book. So thank you.
That's why they pay me the big bucks. You know, nowadays, many people who view older films are troubled by the treatment of race and gender in the golden age of Hollywood. And some films have been given a contextual introductions to help audiences understand the less enlightened era in which they were created. But with Jane Russell, it was like the entire way her image was focused on her impressive chestal area. And she was in a movie with Groucho Marx and Frank Sinatra, which was called It's Only Money, but because Jane was in it, they changed the title to Double Dynamite. So how did you approach writing about this?
Well, that was, you know, in the, as you said, like the subtitle of the book is Jane Russell and the Marketing of a Hollywood Legend. And, you know, that was something I really wanted to explore because the marketing of Jane, her entire career and her entire life, like was around her chest. And when I was researching her, I came to find that she often was treated almost as an inanimate object, you know, particularly in writing about, you know, her relationship with Howard Hughes and the outlaw. And there's a lot of literature out there on that. But again, I never felt like we truly understood kind of Jane's opinion of it all and how she felt about it and how she was impacted by it. And so that was one of my goals with the book, was to really look at it. I was very tempted to include a glossary of all of the words that were used to describe her. I started actually keeping a list and then I thought, oh, I'm not going to put a glossary in the back. But it is kind of amazing, like how often, and even now, you know, people, I think because that is how she was treated her entire career in her entire life, people still often make the comments now. So I've been kind of doing daily Jane Russell posts on Twitter and, you know, people sometimes just make comments that I don't, you know, which kind of strike me like, oh man, just don't go there. But I think we've spent, you know, almost 80 years talking about Jane that way, that it still seems to be kind of accepted. You know, I was even looking at a video clip. It was Bob Hope and Barbara Mandrell on her show in the 80s. And like she was making comments about Jane's physical attributes as well, and cracking jokes about it. So
I guess to defer to cracks about her own anatomy.
Yeah.
Barbara Mandrell was also.
Yeah, so, you know, so, but yeah, that's definitely something that I wanted to explore. And I really wanted to explore how Jane felt about it and kind of how she was able to just reconcile having a career that focused so much on that.
And you found some stuff. I mean, I have read other things, including Karina Longworth's great book about Howard Hughes' seduction. But you found some stuff that I had never seen before and couldn't really believe that, you know, Howard Hughes has these detailed, you know, discussions of the shape of her breast and how her breast appears and how he is unhappy because it looks like she's padded. I mean, that was really some detail.
Yeah, I think I have like the line in the book, like, I don't know if Jane was really aware just how much attention Howard Hughes paid to her nipples, because he would. There was this, you know, 800 word memo all about the gold mesh dress in Macau that, he down to just every last detail, reiterating it over and over. And he was quite obsessed with it, quite obsessed with how she looked on screen.
And just because she has large breasts does not mean that she is not a good actress.
Not at all. Not at all. And she is, I mean, she's just one of those people that I think is just an absolute towering personality. It, you know, she was, she was so photogenic, and you just look at her on screen and like, my God, like she was a movie star. She really, really was just a larger than life personality.
Well, Christina Rice, how did Jane Russell get into the movies in the first place?
Yeah, kind of accidentally. So she was, you know, her mother had been a stage actress with, you know, kind of moderate success. So that was something that was always at the back of her mom's mind. And, you know, her mom claimed she named her Jane Russell because she thought it would look good in lights on a marquee. And so I think her mom certainly didn't push her into it at all. And her mom wasn't like a stage mom, but I think kind of subtly was always planting that seed. And Jane kind of toyed with it. Maybe I want to, maybe I don't. The thing about Jane, which she would always be the first to admit, is that she was kind of lazy. So, you know, someone like Marilyn Monroe, who so aggressively pursued that career and just put so much of herself into it, that wasn't Jane. It all seemed to kind of come to Jane. So she did take some acting lessons, which she studied at Max Reinhardt's school. He had a school on Sunset Boulevard. Most of the time she ditched and went to a bowling alley across the street. Maria Ospinskaya had an acting school, and Jane, you know, she took classes there and enjoyed it well enough. And, you know, what happened is she starts modeling for Tom Kelly, and he's a photographer who most people are familiar. He shot the nude photos of Marilyn for the Golden Dreams calendar. Mm-hmm. So Jane modeled for him, always with clothes on. So she did a lot of clothes modeling shoots for catalogs and whatnot. And her photo was hanging up in his studio, and a local agent would visit Tom Kelly scouting kind of to see if he had any fresh faces. And Levis Green was the name of the agent. He saw Jane's, and it was a close-up photo of her. It wasn't even a photo, you know, showing her physicality. It was a close-up portrait of her.
It was her face.
It was her face. It's this intense photo of her kind of almost snarling. And he knew that Howard Hughes and Howard Hawks, who was the original director of The Outlaw, were looking for unknowns for the role of Rio. So he swiped the photo from Tom Kelly's studio and submitted it. And they decided they wanted her for a screen test. And, you know, when Jane got opportunities, she took them. She didn't necessarily pursue them. But when they came her way, she was off and running, and she did the screen test, and Howard Hughes and Howard Hawks liked what they saw. She got cast in the movie. Hughes signed her to the long-term contract and held onto her for dear life, you know, for the next 30 plus years.
Right. Yeah. Her contract to him went on for many, 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 many years.
Yeah.
That was very interesting to learn about in your book. So unlike most actresses, she made a splash in her first picture and then did not. It's not like, oh, she made 10 pictures that year or something. That picture took forever. I mean, she was already a star by the time the picture came out just because of publicity. And how many years went by between the time she shot the thing and the time it came out?
Oh my God, it's incredible. And I have to say, that was one of the things that always confused me about Jane, because I knew about her. You know, I knew her growing up from Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. I knew about The Outlaw. I knew she looked very different. I knew there was a huge age difference between the two, but she's not somebody that's really, I don't think, thought of as a 40s film actress. So The Outlaw starts filming at the end of 1940. It finishes sometime in 41. It premieres in 1943 in San Francisco, has, I think, like a 6 or 7 week run in San Francisco. And then it is released limited by United Artists in 1946. And it actually is not widely released until 1950 through RKO.
Wow, so 10 years.
It took essentially 10 years for that movie to come out.
And by the time it came out, had she appeared in other pictures, or were they still kind of holding back to make that be her debut movie?
So she did The Young Widow, which came out in 1946. And there was some negotiating on when it could be released because of The Outlaw. And then she does The Pale Face in 1948. And she also does Double Dynamite in Montana Belle in 49. But Hughes, you know, obtains them and puts them on the shelf for a few years. So throughout the entirety of the 1940s, she only shows up on screen 3 times. But because of the publicity campaign around The Outlaw, which was handled by Russell Birdwell, who's just a legendary PR guy who did the search for Scarlett for Gone with the Wind, who's just a character in his own right, she became an international movie star. And her nickname for many years was the motionless picture actress, because she wasn't on screen. But she comes around when the U.S. is, you know, gearing up to enter the war, and once we do enter the war, she becomes just one of the most popular pinups, you know, throughout the duration.
So as a person who was marketed solely on, I mean, it's kind of, I can't think of other people who have had that happen that are not just models. I mean, it has happened to, you know, somebody like Cindy Crawford or something where she's, you know, she's based on what she looks like. But for someone who's an actress, I don't know, maybe Farrah Fawcett, when her famous Farrah Fawcett poster made her a big star, bigger star than she had been on television. But so here's somebody who's completely marketed based on her looks and the way that those poses, you go into detail about her lying on a hay bale with torn shirt open. And how did that gel with the actual personality of Jane Russell?
It wasn't her at all. Which is one of the things that I find so fascinating. You know, she rolled her eyes and laughed at the way she was marketed. She was, you know, she strikes me as being just a very down to earth person. She had four brothers, so she was the oldest of five kids. So she just never took herself seriously. She just couldn't, with having those five younger brothers who, you know, made fun of her and, oh, you're such a movie star. So she was never a prima donna. She was very down to earth. She was kind of a tomboy. You know, when she was at home, I think she preferred to hang out in jeans. So she, you know, I think laughed at the notion that she was a sex symbol, and she was a woman of tremendous, religious faith. So, you know, she was always very quick to talk about, you know, how she, the Bible was her spiritual guide. And she did that throughout her entire career. And I find it interesting that Howard Hughes, I think they had such an interesting dynamic between them, is that he was obsessed with how she looked on screen. He was obsessed with how she was marketed, but he never tried to dictate how she conducted herself off screen. So like off screen and giving interviews, you know, she was 100% Jane Russell, and on screen, she was something completely different, and they both were kind of able to deal with it. But I don't know, even if Howard Hughes had ordered her to act like a sex pot off screen, I think she would have just laughed at him. She was one of the few who could.
Howard Hughes had a lot of actresses that he put under contract. Then he put them in hotels or apartments and told them that they were going to marry him. And he married a few of them. I don't know. But that he never had that kind of a relationship with Jane Russell.
He didn't, because she was in a relationship with Robert Waterfield, Bob Waterfield, the football player, before she became a film star. So she was already like in this relationship, and she was just absolutely nutty about Bob Waterfield, and Howard Hughes was never going to come between the two. And I think he might've been a little bit intimidated by this football player. So I think that's something that always, that just set her apart in many respects, is that, you know, she got married in 1943. They eloped to Las Vegas and got married. So, I do think that set her apart from a lot of the other, women that Hughes kind of had in his stable. And I think she was just, you know, she was such a force to be reckoned with, like on screen and off. So that was one of the things I had a lot of fun with in researching and writing the book, was just that dynamic between Jane and Howard Hughes. Because she wasn't that concerned with actually having a big film career. Like, you know, she enjoyed making pictures and, you know, she wanted it to an extent, but if Hughes had pushed her in a way where she just felt she needed to walk away, I don't think she would have had a problem with that. And I think he identified that. And so he pushed her as far as he could, but she would push back if necessary.
And she remained under contract with him for, as you were saying, for decades. And they had a kind of a strange contract where she just got paid whether she made any pictures or not.
Yeah. So she signed, you know, her contract would expire and then she would re-up. And her first contract, you know, was terrible. Like, you know, for many players when they're first starting out, it wasn't a great contract. And eventually Levis Green, her agent was at a smaller agency, and then he went to MCA. And so she fell under the umbrella of Lou Wasserman. And Wasserman just for years wanted to get Jane away from Howard Hughes. But Jane was just somebody, when she gave somebody her word that she would do something, she would see it through. So because she had signed a contract with Hughes, she wouldn't break it. And I think Hughes admired that loyalty so much and so appreciated it that as every time she went to renew her contract, he would give her a pretty sweet deal. And finally, at the end, she was kind of ready to be done with him over the French line, over how he had promoted the French line and, you know, which caused the Catholic Church to declare it a mortal sin in St. Louis. And she was done. And he finally offers her this contract for, you know, I think it was like $1 million, but she got paid like $1,000 a week over the course of 20 years. And even Lou Wasserman said, you can't say no to that. So, she stopped making movies and continued to get paid for a really long time. And she always felt because she had been loyal in the early 40s and hadn't walked away from her contract when people were whispering in her ear to do so, he rewarded her.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking tonight with Christina Rice. She's the author of Anne Dvorak, Hollywood's Forgotten Rebel, and a new biography called Mean, Moody, Magnificent, Jane Russell and the Marketing of a Hollywood Legend.
As I'm reading your book, just the same way when I enjoyed your Anne Dvorak book, you know, I'm looking for the movies and watching them as I go. And there were many Jane Russell films that I hadn't seen or hadn't seen in a long time. It was really fun to watch them again. But The French Line, I haven't seen. And I want to see the version that you're talking about in the book that you've apparently seen that was eventually censored. So talk a little bit about this dance sequence and where somebody could find the uncensored version of it if they wanted.
Yeah, so The French Line has this number at the very end of the movie, and it was tacked on. So I think they filmed this movie and then realized that, you know, it's a musical. And Jane, you know, has numbers throughout. And at one point she does a duet with Mary McCarty. And I think Hugh said, wait a second, we need to give our star a show-stopping number. And so they give her Looking for Trouble. And there was this, I think probably the biggest kind of battle between Jane and Howard Hughes came over this musical number, because Hughes wanted her to wear kind of a bedazzled jeweled bikini for the number, which Jane, you know, she would agree to a lot of what Hughes wanted of her. And that was the one, you know, and she went so far as to do costume fittings for it and said, I can't do it. I cannot go on screen wearing because bikinis just were, you know, as Jane would say, it was only the naughty French girls that wore bikinis at the time. And so she actually walked off the picture. And so they made a compromise. And so it's this leotard with teardrop cutouts. And the number is, I think it's very, I think even by today's standards, it is pretty darn saucy. And mainly because of the camera, it's like these close-ups and these camera angles when she's talking about, you know, popping the corn in Nebraska. And I think it's a kick. It's really fun to watch. And she has this monologue in the middle, you know, and she's talking about the men that she likes, and it's saucy, but it's really fun. And Jane ended up ultimately having a problem with it. One, because she didn't realize just how they were filming her, that they were kind of filming her from above looking down her costume, which was very low because Hughes always wanted her in like low cut strapless things. And the number comes out of nowhere and it makes no sense. And according to Jane, there was like another scene preceding it, which explains why she would do this number. And that's not in the movie. So it just makes absolutely no sense. But because it was so controversial at the time, there is a version of it that is shot in extreme long shot. So it's all the same moves. It's the same number, but it's in long shot and it's just super boring. Like, it is amazing how camera angles and editing, they make a huge difference in the monologue. So I think when TCM airs it, it usually is that version. But I think if you go online, you can, you know, probably do like French Line uncensored version and at least see that musical number, because the rest of the film's the same. It's just the musical number. And I have a copy that I downloaded off the internet just in case it ever got pulled, because I wanted to be able to access it anytime. So, you know, maybe I can, if people want to contact me, I can share the uncensored version of Jane popping the corn in Nebraska.
I knew that Jane Russell had a recording career, but I think, you know, some of the readers would be surprised the extent of her recording career. She had record albums and 78 record albums, and she made pop records, and then she did a whole career as a gospel singer. Talk a little bit about her recording career.
Yeah. So Jane absolutely loved to sing, and which is something Howard Hughes was really hesitant to let her do out in public, but she finally convinced him. And so Kay Kaiser invited her to come on his show. And so she ended up becoming a regular, and she did record songs with him. Yeah. She had a whole 78 set. I think Let's Put Out the Lights was the name of the set. Yeah. She recorded lots of singles, her films, you know, and she ended up singing in the majority of her films. She actually does end up singing in Montana Belle was the first one. And she also had a nightclub. So she would tour and do nightclub performances and do like whatever, what the remnants of vaudeville, like in the 40s and 50s. So in between films, like she had it put into her contract with Hughes later on that she would be allowed to go do this. So it was something she did her entire career. She had a nightclub act up until almost to the day she died. So she was living up in Santa Maria and was bored out of her mind. And so she made arrangements with the local hotel to have a regular nightclub act that she would do. And then she also, with Connie Haynes and Beryl Davis, and then off and on Della Russell and Rhonda Fleming, they would record kind of this Christian gospel pop records. And so they did a few singles and a couple of full-on albums, and she would tour. She toured the country. She actually toured the world. Record, you know, she went down to Australia, and I think they went to South America. So that was a very prominent part of Jane's career, especially after she stopped making movies. She would tour with this. So there are a lot of Jane Russell recordings out there.
There's a lovely company out of England that is called Sepia Records, and they have re-released almost all of Jane Russell's music on CD.
Oh, I didn't even realize that. See, I've been going on like buying 78s. Trying to hear everything.
So Miss Jane Russell Sings.
Oh, that's amazing.
And this one has that As Long As I Live, which is the record that she recorded with Kay Kaiser, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it might sound better than my 78, too.
Well, I think it might sound better than the 78, but let's find out.
Maybe I can't live to love you as long as I want to. Life isn't long enough, baby, but I can love you as long as I live. And maybe I can't buy you diamonds and things like I want to, but I can promise you, baby, I'm gonna want to as long as I live. Never cared, but now I'm scared. I won't live long enough, that's why I wear my rubbers when it rains. Eat an apple every day and see my doctor anyway. What if I can't live to love you as long as I want to? Long as I promise you, baby, I'm gonna want to as long as I live. Just got one life to live, and I would like to live it all with you, baby, just with you. With you.
Jane Russell, along with Kay Kaiser and his orchestra, As Long As I Live is the name of the track, and we're talking with Christina Rice, and she's the author of Mean, Moody, Magnificent, Jane Russell and the Marketing of a Hollywood Legend.
Yes, you know, and Jane had an absolutely, you know, lovely voice. So, and just loved performing.
Well, let's talk about some of the highlights of her film career, which include her singing, especially Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. I mean, I think Gentlemen Prefer Blondes is the best Marilyn Monroe movie ever, and I think it's probably the best Jane Russell movie ever.
Yeah, I would go so far as to say, I don't even think that's a matter of opinion. I think it's just fact.
Yeah. And I mean, Jane Russell is totally the star of the film. I mean, she and Marilyn work together so well. And she has that scene where she does an impression of Marilyn. That's one of the highlights of the picture, where she
Oh, it is. And it was her, you know, it was her favorite movie. She also loved Fuzzy Pink Nightgown, but she absolutely loved Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and would often say that's the closest to Jane Russell that we'll ever get to see on the big screen.
There's that number in the picture where she is serenading a bunch of men who are athlete. They're the Olympic team or something like that.
Yeah.
And she has a line like, oh, how nice of someone to have put me on a ship with the Olympic team.
Yeah.
And they're wearing these flesh colored suits. So they really look like they're naked. And everybody who's ever seen that picture in a theater just bursts out laughing when that.
Oh yeah. It is a show. And they all, and none of them are paying any attention to her.
Right.
So, but, oh yeah. It's an absolute showstopper. And I think would get pulled when it would, when the movie would screen on TV in England, they would take that out being too controversial a number. But I think it's arguably like the highlight of Jane's career is that number, Ain't There Anyone Here for Love.
So how did she get cast in that picture?
So yeah, my understanding is 20th Century Fox had the rights to Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. So, you know, so it had been written by Anita Loos and had recently been turned into a musical on Broadway with Carol Channing. And so 20th Century Fox, I think, were considering Marilyn for it. Oh, I don't think they were. I think the story that Howard Hawks tells, which I realize Howard Hawks isn't always the most reliable narrator, but his version, which is what I went with in the book, just because I thought it made sense to me, was that Zanuck was trying to figure out what to do with Marilyn. Hawks said, you know, you guys have Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, you have this thing. And, you know, I think Fox constantly underestimated Marilyn. They underestimated her talent. They underestimated her appeal. And they said, well, I don't know. Do you think she could pull it off? And Hawks had just worked with Marilyn in Monkey Business and said, yeah, she absolutely can. But I think you need somebody really strong in the role of Dorothy Shaw who can kind of, you know, prop her up if necessary. And Zanuck said, well, who? And Hawks said, Jane Russell. To which Zanuck said, Howard Hughes is not going to loan me his star. And Hawks said, I discovered her. So, you know, and he called Jane up and said, hey, Janie, I have a role for you. And Jane said, cool, when do we start? So I don't even, you know, and he said, you know, the role of Lorelai, you know, might be more of like the scene stealing. And Jane just said, I don't care, you know, because she had been cast by Hawks for The Outlaw and had started to, you know, had worked with him and had prepped for the movie with him. And Hawks had abruptly quit the movie when him and Howard Hughes didn't see eye to eye. And Jane was devastated and absolutely adored Howard Hawks and desperately, you know, spent over a decade wanting to work with him. So when the opportunity came for her, you know, to work with Howard Hawks at 20th Century Fox in this Technicolor musical, there was no way she was going to allow Howard Hughes to say no. So, so she was loaned out for it. And it was just a fantastic experience.
And I understand that Marilyn was depressed because she got her contract rate and Jane Russell got paid three times as much or something like that.
Yeah, I think Jane, if I'm remembering correctly, I think it was like $175,000 or $200,000 to be in it. Yeah, and Marilyn, you know, apparently didn't even have a star dressing room at that point and finally had to put her foot down and say, you know, whatever I am, I'm the blonde. So you need to get so she did get her dressing room. And, you know, and Jane had this crew of, you know, she had a makeup artist and a hairstylist and like her wardrobe. So she had this whole like little crew of people that came with her, you know, even like the cinematographer, Harry J. Wilde, that was her cinematographer that Howard Hughes insisted, you know, be the one to shoot Jane, and Fox agreed to it. So he shot that. And so Jane always brought her little crew with her everywhere she went. So yeah, Fox really rolled out the red carpet for her and, you know, and she came on. But again, like Jane was just so devoid of ego that she, you know, was always incredibly kind to Marilyn. And, you know, early on in production, Marilyn started to be late to set, and her makeup person, Whitey Snyder, went to Jane's makeup guy, Shotgun Britton, and said, you know, Marilyn's here at the crack of dawn. She's made up. She's ready to go. She is such a ball of nerves that I can't get her out the door. And Shotgun told Jane that, and Jane's like, oh, really? So every morning, Jane would walk past Marilyn's dressing room, like knock on the door, say, okay, Blondel, let's go. Time to go. And Marilyn would come out and go, oh, okay. And it was, you know, and it was fine because Jane wasn't the type of person that, you know, oh, well, the other one has to be the first to show up on set. Like Jane just didn't care. You know, and Jane rolled, you know, Marilyn would be there at 5 a.m. Jane and her crew had Jane's routine down so that they would like roll in like an hour before she had to be on set because Jane, above most things, valued sleep and always insisted on having like her 9 to 10 hours of sleep. So, you know, and she was just having such a great time that it just wasn't a big deal for her to just roll up and get Marilyn on set.
Oh, what a great picture. Gentlemen prefer blondes. I love both pictures that she did. I like her my favorite two co-stars of hers are Robert Mitchum and Bob Hope. I think that she did great work with both of those guys in completely different kinds of pictures, which talks about the versatility of Jane.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that she could, one, that she could hold her own with those people, like that she can, you know, I think Jane's one of the few people who is not just completely blown off the screen by Marilyn, and that she could play opposite someone like Bob Hope. And it is astounding, you know, she does The Outlaw, and if you've seen The Outlaw, oh my gosh, that's an experience. A good one, I doubt it. You know, and then she does The Young Widow, and she's not good in it, and yeah, she would be the first to admit that. And then the next thing people see her in is The Pale Face, and she's fantastic in it, and it's this like very deadpan performance, but yeah, she's absolutely magnificent opposite Bob Hope. And then you get to the two, His Kind of Woman and Macau, like her and Robert Mitchum. You know, she once said, like, why did you two like gel so well on screen together? And she said, I guess we look like we deserved each other. And and they did. Like, they are just absolutely electric together. And I'd also point out Clark Gable, because she does the Tall Men with Clark Gable. Men.
He calls her grandma the whole time.
Calls her grandma. And he would call her grandma, like, off screen. He just ended up calling her grandma off screen as well. And even though, you know, by that point, there certainly was an age difference between the two of them, but you don't even notice. They just, you know, play off so well.
That's a beautifully shot Western, The Tall Men. I love that movie.
I love The Tall Men. That's certainly one that, yeah, I don't know if a lot of people have seen it. That one and Foxfire. Like Foxfire is that, to me, that was the revelation, because I was not aware of that movie at all going into the research. And I absolutely adore that movie.
Well, tell us a little bit about Foxfire.
Yeah. So it's her opposite Jeff Chandler. And it takes place like in a small mining town near a Native American reservation, and you know, and so it deals with, you know, kind of marital conflicts and, you know, racism towards Native Americans, but it's all done like in spectacular Technicolor. You know, it also deals, you know, with miscarriage, and I just think it's just it's funny, you know, it's this movie that I think it was the last movie to be shot in like the three color dye transfer Technicolor. So it's just so stunning. And it's kind of this really small story that's just shot so grandly. But I think it's an interesting film for her. It's, I think it's like a pretty low key film for her. And, you know, I think pushes her a little bit more than a lot of her other films in terms of her performance. So I just recommend it. I think it's just a gorgeous film.
And Jeff Chandler, a fine actor. He died young, so people kind of forgot about him, but he was a good actor.
Oh, he's a good actor, and he's fantastic in this. Yeah, it gets a little bit melodramatic and soapy at the end, almost comically, but I highly recommend it.
I don't mind.
And he sings the title song, Jeff Chandler does.
Oh, yeah, Jeff Chandler sang too.
Yeah.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro here on KSCO, and my guest tonight is Christina Rice. She's a biographer who has written a biography of Anne Dvorak called Anne Dvorak, Hollywood's Forgotten Rebel. And her new book is called Mean, Moody, Magnificent, Jane Russell and the Marketing of a Hollywood Legend.
I think a lot of people remember Jane Russell. People my age remember her as a bra spokesperson. She did a lot of bra commercials, which was kind of ironic for somebody who was pushed into the breast business, so to speak.
Yeah, I think it says a lot about her, about how she didn't take herself seriously, that she was perfectly fine becoming the spokesperson for Playtex bras in the 70s and 80s for the full figured woman. And I think that that was certainly my introduction to her growing up, because those commercials seemed to be, she shot a lot. She was their spokesperson for a decade, through most of the 70s and the early 80s. And so I think a lot of people were introduced to her that way. And I have a wonderful story in the book about her being at making a public appearance, somewhere, and a little boy asking for, to take his picture with her. And she looked at him and said, "You don't know who I am." And he said, "Well, yeah, you're the bra lady." And I was never able to determine exactly who the genius was behind that marketing campaign. But I do commend them.
It's interesting when you look in retrospect at the way people dealt with things. You point out in your book, Mean, Moody, Magnificent, Jane Russell and the Marketing of a Hollywood Legend, that there were these groups that were interested in banning the outlaw or cutting parts or scenes. And then when the rating system came in and they finally gave a rating to the outlaw that was rated G.
Yes. We've come a long way, baby.
But you had to do this book in a much less time than your Anne Dvorak book. I mean, you worked on that book for 12 years. Is that what you told me, or something?
Yeah,
like that?
Somewhere between that. Yeah, 12 or 15 years. Yeah.
And then that couldn't have been that long, because I just read your Anne Dvorak book a little while ago, and now I read this one. So, how were you able to do this one so much more rapidly?
Yeah. Well, I think, on the one hand, I knew what I was doing. So when I first started working on the Anne Dvorak book, I was, I was in my early 20s and just didn't know what I was doing. So I think that is part of it. And with Jane, she is the opposite of Anne, whereas Anne, I had to just dig and dig and dig for any kind of morsel of information. Jane was huge. Like Anne was wonderful, but fairly obscure. Whereas Jane was huge. Like, she was this international star for, almost her entire life, and was hyper documented. So there was so much out there that getting information, actually I had the opposite problem, where it was like, oh my God, what do I include? So with Anne, I think I included almost everything I found. Whereas Jane, I didn't, I don't explore her recording career, as much as I might have, as much as I did with Anne or her television career, because there's just so much out there. And Jane, she was so generous with her time, and she did so many interviews. So it was kind of like going through and deciding, and the really, really great thing about Jane, again, she was so no nonsense. She wasn't obsessed with this image of herself. So she's very reliable. So she is a very reliable narrator. So it's just kind of, okay, which one of these stories that she told like 50 times did she tell the best that I'm going, that I'm going to include in the book? So, finding the information was a lot easier. Well, and just the leaps and bounds in access. So when I first started trying to research Anne, it was the mid-90s. And, when you flash forward all these years, so much is available online now, that it's really easy. When I was writing the book, I might be stuck somewhere and I could just very easily go look up a newspaper article and go, oh no, she was, she was in Silver Springs, Florida on this date for this premiere, because here's the newspaper, reporting on it. So that was part of it. It actually, I was hoping, I think it took me about 5 years. I think I started working on it in early 2016. But I actually hope to have it out sooner than I did. So I think 5 years is pretty good.
Considering you've been doing all these other things at the same time.
I've been doing all these other things. Yeah. And like the last third of the book I wrote during like the first month of lockdown last year. So I hope it's good, because I don't know. I don't even know if I remember that experience. It was like working, sitting at my desk in my bedroom from like 7:30 to 4, doing my day job at the library, eating dinner, and then from like 7 till 1 in the morning writing about Jane. Wow. And I did that for like a month. So I hope it turned out okay, because I think I've blocked all that out. I blocked out the whole experience.
It's more than okay. I'm Christina Rice, I love comic books. I've read comic books my whole life. Mm-hmm. I have never read any My Little Pony comic books. Mm-hmm. In fact, I wasn't really even aware that there were My Little Pony comic books. But there are, and you write them. How many have you written? And who publishes them?
Oh, my God. So IDW is the publisher. Oh, uh-huh. I've written, I don't even know. I actually haven't written any for about a year because I've been working on Jane, but I wrote over 20 issues of it.
And how do you write a My Little Pony comic? And what kinds of things happen in the My Little Pony comic?
Yeah. Well, it was based off of the cartoon. So there was so My Little Pony's been around for a while. So there was,
It was a toy first.
It was
or
a toy first.
Yeah.
No, it was a toy first in the '80s, and then it was a cartoon, and then in I think it was 2009 or 2010, it was completely reimagined and relaunched as a cartoon. And my daughter, she's 10 now, so she was totally obsessed with it. So I was like really familiar with the characters and with the show. And after the Andvorak book came out, my husband is a comic book writer. He's a TV writer now, but he made a living as a comic book writer for like the first 10 years we were together. I think he wanted to stop me from doing another book because it had been so time consuming. So he hooked me up with the editor of the Pony comics, and the guy let me pitch, and I started writing them. And so, it did stop me for, maybe a couple of years from launching into another biography, but no, it's been fun. And certainly gave me street cred with my daughter, when she was in preschool and her friends on the playground.
Mommy writes My Little Pony.
Exactly. Doesn't care about this other book that I wrote, but My Little Pony. But it's fun because I am able to inject, classic Hollywood, I think very subtly. So I have an entire issue that is my tribute to Only Angels Have Wings, the Howard Hawks movie.
Oh, well, do you think anyone of the people reading the My Little Pony comic had any idea what you were doing?
No, absolutely. Nobody caught that. Nobody caught that Jet Glider was Cary Grant's character in that. And I think my proudest moment as a pony comic writer is I had a character that I actually named King Vorak, which was, and that character, and there was always, a pretty strict divide between the comic books and the show. And so, the comic books were, kind of canon in the pony universe until they weren't, until maybe the TV show might contradict it. But in the second to last episode of the entire series, because the cartoon's no longer on, they referenced King Vorak.
Yay! So
that made me very happy that not only did I get Anne Dvorak, into the pony world, but not only in the comic books, but in the actual show as well. So that is one of my prouder moments.
Well, the thing that you do so well in both of your books, and especially in this new one, is to bring these people to life for us to get to know and love. And you do it really well in this book, Mean, Moody, Magnificent, Jane Russell and the Marketing of a Hollywood Legend. Christina Rice, thanks so much for talking to us again on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. And if I can plug my podcast,
do it.
That would be okay.
Absolutely.
So while we've been shut down, my husband, my daughter, and I have launched a podcast called the Little Miss Movies Podcast, where we make her watch movies that we want her to see, whether she wants to or not, and then we discuss.
So what are the movies, what are some of the movies that you've watched that you've tied your daughter to a chair and made her watch?
Yeah, they're kind of all over the place, but we did Citizen Kane. Which she actually loved. So I was really
She's 10 excited. Years old and you
She's 10 years yeah. old.
So yeah. Last Tango in Paris, did you do that one?
Not yet. No. Not yet. We're holding off on the later Brando stuff till she's 12. we did Sunset Boulevard recently. But we did like the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I think we're going to be doing the African Queen soon.
Oh, that's
yeah, for African American History Month, we had some of our friends recommend movies. So we did Devil in a Blue Dress and The Last Dragon. So it's kind of all over the place, kind of what appeals to us. We did Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. So she now kind of, since she was hearing the word filibuster so much, we thought we would.
Even though it's not the same thing, but she
not the same thing, but at least it gives her a little bit of context to go from.
So tell us the name of the podcast again.
The Little Miss Movies Podcast.
Little Miss Movies Podcast. And Mean, Moody, Magnificent, Jane Russell, and the Marketing of a Hollywood Legend, and Dvorak. What's the subtitle?
Hollywood's Forgotten Rebel.
Hollywood's Forgotten Rebel. And the author, the brilliant Christina Rice. Thanks again for being with us.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at FromTheBookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening. And don't forget to join me, Gary Shapiro, tomorrow at noon for the Noon Balloon here on KSCO, where I'll take your calls and we can talk about anything you like. See you then.